Welcome to the 67th A.W. Mellon Lectures in the Fine Arts. In this six-part lecture series, entitled Positive Barbarism, Brutal Aesthetics in the Post-War Period, art historian Hal Foster explores the pervasive turn from the mid-1940s to the early 1960s to the bru and the brutalist, the animal and the creaturely, as these are manifest in the early work of Jean Dubuffet, Georges Bataille, Asger Jorn, Eduardo Paolozzi, and Klaus Oldenburg. In this sixth lecture, entitled Klaus Oldenburg and His Ray Guns, delivered at the National Gallery of Art on May 13, 2018, Foster examines how Oldenburg staked his hope for metamorphosis in the transformation of urban scrap.
Happy Mother's Day. This is the last of my lectures, so I want to thank again all my friends at the National Gallery and CASVA, especially Elizabeth Cropper for her invitation, Teresa O'Malley for her guidance, Elise Ferrone for her help. It's such a gift to be able to do these talks, and it's one that I can't repay. I can't even re-gift. And on that note, I also want to thank Sandy Tate, my partner of 38 years. You know, a poet can say of art what an art historian like me, especially in these lectures, can rarely say. That beauty is truth, truth beauty. When I think of my life, which is to say, when I think of my wife, her beauty is my truth, and that is all I've really needed to know. Here's a photograph of Klaus Oldenburg in 1967, which he placed on the back cover of his collection, writing on the side, 1956-1969. It shows Oldenburg in his New York studio. Numbers and notes are scribbled on the wall, and the door, on which is stenciled, Freude winket, a wordplay typical of the artist. Freude calls up Freud, of course, and Oldenburg was an avid reader of psychoanalysis, as well as Freude, German for joy, and winket is Latin for conquers. So Freud conquers, or joy wins, and maybe Eros and life do too. But there is that pesky skull on top of the exit sign, like a Halloween Yorick, which turns the photo into a little vanitas, with the distracted Oldenburg the subject of his own cautionary tale. However lightly, life and death, love and destruction, are put in tension here allegorically. My thesis for today is that Oldenburg seeks to turn the latter toward the former, and to use both to recharge the aesthetic. That is the primary motive of his positive barbarism. However, Freude, joy, does not always win in Freud, nor does it in Oldenburg. Soon after Oldenburg moved from Chicago to New York in June 1956, the 27-year-old wrote this promissory note: "My art strives for a simultaneous presentation of contraries. It would proceed in this way, too, in a series of grand symbols that contrasted with one another over the first decade of his mature work. First the street, briefly the beach, then the store, and finally the home. Whereas the street, which opened in early 1960, staged an urban world of destitution and death, the store, which appeared in late 1961, explored the opposite themes of abundance and eros. Here, everyday commodities and combustibles were reshaped as though by bodily drives. Death returned in Bedroom Ensemble, which developed in late 1963, but in the different guise of decor, of style as reification. Oldenburg then pivoted again to his soft sculptures, which challenged all things hard and fixed. Not only did he thus proceed by way of contraries, themes of death and sex, qualities of rigid and pliant, but in doing so, he demonstrated that each term calls out for its other. Motto, Oldenburg declared in 1963, things are best if come by from the other side, from their opposite, such as meaning from non-meaning, relation from non-relation. This relational way of working is not only dialectical, but also psychoanalytical in orientation, governed as it is by this premise. I would like to show, Oldenburg wrote already in the mid-1950s, that the psychical and the physical are one. Death in the street. Newly arrived in New York in 1956, Oldenburg noted his attraction to vulgar forms of expression, flawed, stunted. I like beaten, battered things, he added a year later. And related adjectives, blunt, bare, bleak, barren, recur in his notes of the time. What are my preferences in the real world? Oldenburg asked rhetorically in 1959. Present-day primitives, children, madmen, the American culturalists, in general, the bleak, gray face of things, not pastoral, modern man, citified. This is the setting for my mysticism. The street is nature for us, he added. That is, the urban environment of industrial production, consumption, and waste was his universe. Junkyard is beach is street is a related motto of this early period. A refuse lot is in the city is worth all the art stores in the world is another. Note how different this junkyard is from the productscape of pop art, to which Oldenburg is too quickly assimilated, and how similar he is here to Dubuffet, who was indeed an initial influence, as was Celine. Oldenburg also responded to imperatives within the neo-avant-garde. Along with his newfound friends, Red Grooms, Alan Capro, Jim Dine, and Lucas Samaras, he was eager to move beyond the abstract expressionist painting then dominant in New York. We are just a little tired of four sides and a flat face, Oldenburg commented in 1960. I wish to destroy the rectangle and substitute the medium of indefinite form. Hence the turn of this whole group to found objects, assemblages, and happenings, which Oldenburg regarded as not real theater, but actual painting pushed into space like living sculpture. His first foray in this mode was the street, which opened on January 30th, 1960, in the basement of Judson Church on Washington Square, under the rubric, The Ray Gunn Show. One inspiration for the objects that littered the street came from a book of suggestions for art classes for kids that Oldenburg found at the Cooper Union Library while he worked, where he worked as a shelver. Dubuffet, a great advocate of the art of both children and graffitis, was also on his mind, as was Art Brut in general. Oldenburg had seen this work in Chicago. For the street, he hewed rough forms out of paper, cardboard, burlap, and wood, much of which was scavenged from the street, and outlined them in black ink and charcoal to make them look charred. He also molded lumpen figures out of wire, covered them with newspaper soaked in wheat paste, and dribbled them with casein and enamel. These ragged shapes lined the space and hung from the ceiling while the floor was covered with newspapers, bottles, and other debris. This panorama of urban life included cars, an airplane, various heads and signs, a barking dog, a display window, a shoeshine man, a bicyclist, and a number of figures armed with ray guns. And yet, for all its activity, the street remained a wasteland, a post-apocalyptic world that was also personal nightmare. Oldenburg subtitled the street A New Realism. The city is not ordered, he wrote soon after coming to New York. People and things are without differentiation. Yet rather than simply document this urban formlessness, Oldenburg exacerbated it. And this excessive mimesis is still evident in the tidier version of the street staged at the Rubin Gallery in summer 1960. Consider, for example, his mug, which is a cross between a coffee cup and a street bum, with a bandaged mess for a head, a shapeless torso for a body, and an obscene pendant that it is once penile and fecal. Although the word mug connotes the ugly and the criminal, ugly mug, mug shot, mug goes further. Its portrait of a street person as a broken thing advances a dystopian view of the city as an abject zone of indistinction between subject and object. A person on the street is more of the street than he is human, Oldenburg claimed. And the Bowery in particular is a devastated area where the people become the equivalents of, say, a rag on the street. However, rather than retreat in disgust, he identified with this condition. One of his avatars during this time was the rag man. For Baudelaire, the rag picker was a figure on the margins of capitalist economy who was able to find value even in refuse. For Oldenburg, the rag man was simply a rag, man reduced to refuse. Other avatars in the street, such as the death head, street chick, you see her in the middle, also evoked the city as a place of bare life. And this dark vision runs back to his first days in New York. What our civilization is an old, unshaven man with an open mouth, whose legs and arms have been cut off, whose tongue has been cut out, whose ears have been cut off, whose eyes have been cut out, who drools as he rolls his way along the asphalt. This is the same being in extremis that the positive barbarians of Walter Benjamin took up, the naked man of the contemporary world who lies screaming like a newborn babe in the dirty diapers of the present. If the city at large is the setting of everyday agony for Oldenburg, the street is death. Here, the new realism of the street shades into a winter allegory, which Oldenburg acted out at Judson Church in a series of performances titled Ray Gun Specs. The first of these happenings was Snapshots from the City, which Oldenburg termed a psychasthenic spectacle. Psychasthenia is a technical word for a neurotic breakdown, but it can also signify an utter disillusion of the human subject. And this is what Snapshots seem to stage. The performance included Samaras, Patty Mucha, whom Oldenburg married in April, and Oldenburg strewn with rags. Mucha, as the street chick, wears a primitivist Dadaist mask. And Oldenburg, as the beggar, dances wildly, convulsively, a cross between a shaman and a psychotic. As Oldenburg wrote, these were only fragments of action, immobilized by instantaneous illuminations. And these flashes, the snapshots of the title, were intended to make the viewer convulse as well. To perform the everyday agony of the city in this manner was to do a few contradictory things at once. First, Oldenburg saw the street as an anti-bourgeois, anti-capitalist cabaret, and the happenings as a form of mime. Again, this points to a strategy of mimetic excess, one affined with the Cabaret Voltaire performances of Zurich Dada 50 years before, that aimed to intensify the effects of the city filth, the evils of advertising, the disease of success and popular culture. I am a moralist, Oldenburg commented, in language that recalls Hugo Ball, the first ringleader of Zurich Dada. I would say, face yourself, even if it means destruction. Yet this excess also worked to defend against these conditions. And sometimes in the street, his ragmen did assume the epitropeic guise of the scarecrow. This is another Oldenburg avatar. Finally, this excessive mimesis sought to transform these conditions too, at least imaginatively. Above all, Oldenburg wanted to make hostile things human. That is, to de-reify the alien world of urban capitalism and to reanimate it in other ways. The dialectical dimension of his project thus emerges, for even as the street reduced persons to objects, it also treated things as human. In its own manner, Mug does both. Thus, as much as the street is death for Oldenburg, it is also a festival of the living object. And this festival is even more pronounced in the store. Here we glimpse his version of positive barbarism, which attempts to take bleakness as modern, to learn how to live with it, even to love it. Oldenburg offered the ray gun as a master term for this metamorphosis, whereby an object becomes, if not an animate subject, at least an ambiguous sign. He first mentioned the ray gun in November 1959 while at work on the street, and he soon placed the store under its aegis too. Of course, a ray gun is a science fiction weapon, and there is a photo of the young Klaus with his little brother Richard, who would grow up to be the director of the Museum of Modern Art, costumed a la Buck Rogers. The term is an elastic one for Oldenburg. In fact, elasticity is what his ray gun performs. Along with a multitude of objects, he applied the word to drawings, notes, posters, happenings, and spaces. Ray gun as the street, ray gun as the store, ray gun as the factory, Oldenburg exclaimed about three sites where objects are discovered, bought, and produced, respectively. This obsessive word functions as a magical performative utterance that not only nominates different things as ray guns, but also transforms the ray gun into different things. It aims to charge them all in the process, again, to make hostile objects human. What sort of artistic device is the ray gun? Oldenburg described it only semi-facetiously as capacious. Nothing is irrelevant. Anything can be used. Visionary. Ray gun was not invented. It was received. Even messianic, the whole world begins to see as ray gun sees. More prosaically, it diverges from both the ready-made and the found object in a manner that became axiomatic for Oldenburg. An object that is neither ready-made nor fabricated ready-made, he proclaimed a few years after the store. Those are the rules. Unlike the ready-made, the ray guns aim to be transformative, not tautological. They resist the reduction of art to commodity. And unlike the found object, at least in the surrealist definition, they are public, not private. They are not addressed to one psyche alone. In fact, Oldenburg imagined the ray gun as a guise whose metamorphic power extends to subjects and objects alike, to everyone and everything that comes into contact with it. With his ray guns, then, Oldenburg moved to transform the deathly indistinction of the street into an ambiguous liveliness. Some of these qualities are already evident in the street ray guns, a first collection of eight objects in the vague shape of a toy gun, produced in painted plaster and leather and presented in a thin white case. On the one hand, these ray guns look like scrap. On the other, arranged in a manner that is not strictly personal, commercial, or museological, They are artifacts with a significance and a value we cannot specify. And this passage from known object to enigmatic sign animates them. Already, his project not only to make hostile objects human, but also to find the spiritual in the material is underway. That most of these ray guns are knobby, like handles as well as guns, formed by the hand, for the hand, contributes to the effect. As its title suggests, Empire Papa Ray Gun is the ur-object in this series. Oldenburg first dangled it like a huge hunk of meat, it's roughly 3 by 4 feet, from the ceiling of the street. Made of newspaper soaked in wheat paste, shaped over a wire frame, and dribbled with black casein, this obscene object is both an absurd weapon and a mock phallus, one that is undercut precisely because it is overblown, a deflation through inflation that became a common move in his subsequent work. Its title also diminishes by doubling. The scare quotes only compound the travesty. And its trigger, a pointy penis, renders the bulbous gun more ludicrous still. In the midst of the Cold War, and in advance of the feminism of the 1960s, Oldenburg pillories patriarchy as phallic power in both public, political, and private domestic guises. Empire and Papa are strung up together. 9 years later, Louise Bourgeois hung her more literal version in latex over plaster. I think my mother would have killed me if she had known that I'd shown this slide on Mother's Day, but it's too late now. Empire Papa Ray Gun is also an early instance of another move characteristic of Oldenburg, which is to combine penile forms with fecal ones. Implicitly, this gesture challenges the adult order of genitality with the infantile one of anality. But there's more here. To repeat a line from my talk on Dubuffet, in psychoanalysis, the anal zone is one of formal indistinction, which is to say of symbolic ambiguity. The infant does not much distinguish between feces, penises, and babies. An Empire Papa Ray gun is such a confused object, a gun that is also a penis with a handle that oscillates between testicles and breasts. It is, as Oldenburg said in another context, double-sexed. There are precedents for this ambisexuality in modernist sculpture. Although Brancusi anointed his Princess X, an abstracted bust of Marie Bonaparte, the eternal feminine, Picasso declared it to be a phallus. And in his own surrealist sculptures of his mistress, Marie-Thérèse Walter, Picasso indulged in a similar conflation of penis with nose and breast with head. Oldenburg was not above this semi-sadistic play. His woman's leg is another phallic ray gun. But again, the distinctive aspect of his early work is its mixing of the penile and the fecal, which was already active in his suite of 18 collages titled Strange Eggs. In an influential essay on the meaning of the phallus of 1958, Jacques Lacan argued that the phallus is not an object, but a signifier. In fact, it is the master signifier because it articulates sexual difference, which governs all other differences in language above all. On the one hand, Oldenburg posits his ray gun as a master signifier too. Like the phallus for Lacan, it is a copula that connects and transforms a myriad things, with the magical power that he evoked in this enigmatic formula of 1963. The ray gun image in all is the symbol of the secret image function of the object. On the other hand, Oldenburg seems to mock the supposed mastery of this phallus, its secret image function, in large part through the very profusion of his ray guns. "It's just my luck," he commented in 1969, that everything comes out like a prick. We're still in Empire Papa Reagan and other instances. Oldenburg pitches his phallic signifier in the place of excrement. Oldenburg spent the summer of 1960 in Provincetown, an interlude that served as an obliteration by non-city nature of my involvement with the city street. There he focused on another motif that he dubbed a guise, this one based on the American flag. Here too, Oldenburg transformed sundry objects, many found on the beach, into minimal signs. And again, he drew on popular culture. If his ray guns riffed on science fiction, his flags played with folk art, including the beachcomber as amateur artist. At the same time, he also responded to advanced painting. The flags are made out of what I take to be the basic pictographic elements, Oldenburg commented. Like the tree or the pier for Mondrian, his flag was a way both to break down a picture to its fundamental horizontals and verticals, and to complicate the opposition of figure and ground essential to any image making. High modernist ends achieved in an ironic fashion by folk art means. Clearly, Oldenburg had the recent flags of Jasper Johns in his sights too, but he troped this immediate precedent as well. Where Johns reduced a potent symbol to a physical thing, Oldenburg transformed physical things into ambiguous signs. This is the case throughout his work. The literal serves to support the semiotic, not to stymie it. The old dump flag, the title points to another source of his materials, consists of six pieces of scrap wood attached to a rough plank. Five of the pieces are old dowels. One is cut in two, set on top of each other, end to end, so as to signify the red and white stripes of the flag, which a dark block represents, while a dark block represents the blue rectangle of white stars. Cornville flag looks even simpler. Here the stripes are signified by a dirty white rectangle riddled with paint cracks, and the stars by a small gray shingle in the upper left of the panel. Oldenburg attached a little stick to this weathered rectangle in a way that suggests a smaller flag. And this minor addition opens up a mise en abyme of banners. At the same time, the larger flag is framed by two wood semicircles, a rough one above and a smooth one below, to imply a circle that could signify earth, moon, sun, or the entire cosmos. Essential to the flags, then, is less the neo-dada redemption of refuse as art, which was soon to be a cliche of the period, than the semiotic paradox that the more elemental a sign is, the more multivalent it can become. For Oldenburg, everything must have as model a primitive form, by which he meant not that all things can be reduced to a prototype, much less an archetype, but on the contrary, that a simple shape can generate different meanings, and conversely, that disparate things can produce similar images. Along with the ray guns, this insight is first intuited in his three street heads, each of which is a rough oval that can signify any number of reference. Head is not the first that comes to mind. Yet it is developed programmatically in flags. I feel content should be as open as possible, and that is not to say vague. This is a central lesson about the secret image function of the object that Oldenburg learned at the time. And it recalls the famous aperçu extracted by Picasso from his Gribo mask while at work on his guitar constructions of 1912. That an element in a picture or a sculpture signifies primarily not by reference to things in the world, but according to its differential position within a contextual system of other elements. Here a cylinder signifies eye in the mask and hole in the guitar. If the ray guns reduce the object as form in order to open it up as sculpture, the flags do much the same with painting. At this moment, Oldenburg wrote a poem that speaks to this protean dimension, P dot 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 G. The title invites us, as in a crossword puzzle, to fill in the ellipses with the word painting. And the poem casts this art as a sleeping beauty that has slept so long in its gold crypts, in its glass graves, entombed by conventional frames. Oldenburg urges painting to assume other forms. It is asked out to go for a swim, is given a cigarette, a bottle of beer, even given the chance to be a flag, or a shirt, a tie, a pair of pants, a suit of clothes. Clearly, Oldenburg looks ahead to the subject matter of the store. Bolder and bolder, it becomes anything it wants to be, a hamburger, an ice cream cone, a newspaper, a sewing machine, a bicycle, or a steak. Impossible, inexhaustible, P, dot, 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 G. Like the ray guns, the flags suggest a repurposing of the found object that also targets the commodity, which Oldenburg could not escape in Provincetown, a village focused on the commercialization of patriotism and history. At the same time, he deemed this town a fitting place for a fresh start, given that the pilgrims had landed there before Plymouth Rock. And in his semi-facetious way, Oldenburg indulged his own fantasy of utter primacy. Not just any flag or flag maker, he asserted, I am flag, I am Betsy Ross. And not just any beachcomber, he claimed, I am Robinson Crusoe. A first man in the mold of Walt Whitman too, Oldenburg does not behold creation so much as he articulates it. I take the pieces from the shore and make a statement on the order of things. And here, however hubristic the act might be, the simplest material suffices to make or remake the first sign. Two pieces float up to me in the water, asking to be joined. Joining them, I see that I have participated in a blasphemy, but I can't dispose it. Okay, on to Sex in the Store. With his intuition about the secret image function of the object developed through the ray guns and the flags, Oldenburg was ready to launch his second major project, the store. In the end, it consisted of nearly 60 sculptures, all made of muslin or burlap soaked in plaster, shaped over chicken wire and painted with bright enamels. The gaudy colors in marked contrast with the grim palette of the street. Oldenburg based the objects on the cheap food and clothing on sale on the Lower East Side, which he both produced in a rented storefront in the neighborhood, there you have the address, and sold there for 2 months. The store thus combined studio and gallery as well. After the non-city of the beach, Oldenburg was back in his urban habitat, and once again he proceeded by way of contraries. If the street was filled with trash and haunted by poverty and death, the store was given over to products and animated by profusion and eroticism. However, like the deathliness of the street, the eroticism of the store was no simple matter. The erotic or the sexual is the root of art, its first impulse, Oldenburg wrote soon after the opening. But this root had become entwined with fetishistic stuff. Implicitly then, the fetishism at issue in the store is double. Fetishism as in Freud, the diversion of a sexual aim to a non-sexual object, evident perhaps in bralette or blue and pink panties, and fetishism as in Marx, the investment of an object with a value, even a life, that it does not intrinsically possess. Several of the store objects seem almost alive. Oldenburg thus pitted the sexual fetish against the commodity fetish so as to pathologize the commercial products that make up his subject matter. Or more precisely, he compounded the two fetishisms in a way that underscored how they are already conflated in post-war consumerism, which is, after all, a system that thrives on the sex appeal of the commodity. This is less to pathologize any product than to indicate that it is given to us already as perverse. Certainly, the store objects, fragmented and superimposed as they often are, bear the stigmata of this double fetishization. On the one hand, then, Oldenburg still sought to make hostile objects human, to reclaim a magic in materials. On the other, he revealed how these objects were already estranged, almost beyond recognition. So too, he worked both to restore the erotic root of art and to exploit the intense satanic vulgarity of the fetishistic stuff that charged it. This gives the object an intensity, and this is what I try to project. In the first instance, Oldenburg pursued this double project through a subject matter of inexpensive stuff. With a cash register placed prominently in the space and price tags painted on several objects, the store tries to overcome the sense of guilt connected with money and sales. At the same time, he imbues his things with attributes, cheap, perishable, tactile, erotic, that contrast with the qualities usually associated with art, expensive, permanent, optical, detached. In spring 1961, while at work on the store, Oldenburg wrote his celebrated manifesto, I Am Foreign Art, which advances an active bodiliness in artistic matters, sensuous and sexual, against the quiet contemplation of traditional aesthetics. And in the store, he worked to deliver on this call, to return desires and drives to art making according to the formula, art equals food and it equals sex. Oldenburg also pushed his dual project in the manufacture of his objects, which he described as an erotomystical ritual of mixing plaster and pouring. Fashioned by hand with the essential help of his wife, Patty, the store products are unique, even eccentric, in vivid contrast with the serial sameness of standard commodities. Already evident in the street and the flags, the repurposing of the ready-made and the found object is extreme here. Once again, the point is not the tautology of art as ready-made product, but the transformation of artwork and commodity alike. Through obsession, fragmentation, and combination, Oldenburg sought not only to individualize single objects, but to surprise them into a new category of thing, being even. Exactly what kind of body does the store recover for art? In various texts, Oldenburg tries out different tropes, such as the store as sex, storage, womb, breast, testicles, any containing part of the body, or the store as birth, form from cast, inside, soft cast, uterus, are all birth parallels, parodies, paraphrases. In the process, he confuses genders as well as senses. Is any term primary or even separate? Or is his aim precisely to mix and to muddle? I Am Foreign Art of Kid Smells, Oldenburg proclaimed in I Am Foreign Art. Here the store is imagined as a theater of regression where forms are confused, the drives override all other forces, and the more primitive stages, the oral and the anal, take revenge on the more advanced ones, the phallic and the genital. In this respect, ice cream sandwich can be taken as an exemplary object, an obscene maw painted all American red, white, and blue. It looks like a double-sexed mouth and anus in one. Oldenburg associated the store with incorporation and evacuation. Store is cloaca. Defecation is passage, as is art at large. The act of art is symbolized by eating, digesting, and defecating. For Ernest Jones, a close associate of Freud, the prototype of art making is our infantile shaping of feces. This might be what Oldenburg meant by the first impulse of art and what he wanted to reclaim in the store. Again, in a Dubuffetian way, Oldenburg described his sculpture as poopy. Poopy is my medium, he remarked. And some of his store objects do appear less half-baked than half-digested. Residual objects pass through the insides of a body. This is true of cash register, which looks as though it were partially dissolved by intestinal acids, as well as jacket and shirt fragment with its fecal browns and blood reds. In such work, the clean sheen of the commodity is complicated by the visceral viscosity of the body. In fact, just as Oldenburg combined two kinds of fetishisms, he also crossed two orders of consumption. Bodily consumption corrodes commercial consumption. Corrode, from the Latin rodere, to gnaw. Once more, Oldenburg undercuts pop art, even as he also points to its own repressed anality. Before pop, there was poopy. 2 points should be underscored here. Oldenburg believed that art must grow out of impulses that produce real power. And again, he tapped the two drives, the oral and the anal, which centered on incorporation and evacuation, are the most violent in nature. At the same time, these two zones are also the most metamorphic. Recall that for Freud, the anal stage is one of symbolic transformation, which Oldenburg deemed absolutely essential. In this respect, the model of his sculptures might not be the fetish after all. That is, if we understand the fetish to be a thing that fixes, that arrests desire. For Oldenburg wanted his objects to be constantly elusive. My work is always on its way between one point and another, he averred. And to evoke this transit, Oldenburg offered this riff on the store. Cock and balls. Cock and balls equals tie and collar equals leg and bra equals stars and stripes. Flag equals cigarette package and cigarettes. Heart equals balls and triangle equals upside down girdle and stockings equals sideways cigarette package equals flag. Given that it tends toward the phallic, this free association is not so free. Yet not everything comes out as a prick. There are several elusive jumps here between objects and orientations, subjects and sexes. Oldenburg mimicked a regression to the oral and the anal, not only in the store, but also in the mama babble of I Am for an Art and other texts of the time. As Julia Robinson has argued, this is a regression staged in order to mark out a path back from alienated object relations. Thus, his is an attack on the symbolic order only in the first instance. Just as important is the search for a different language. At one point, Oldenburg termed his idiom abfant, a play on infant that combines abstract and fantastic. The breakdown of the symbolic, the celebration of the formless, is only an initial move that prepares a ground where object relations might develop anew, or at least where unexpected signs can be gleaned from everyday stuff, from things seen in the street, on the beach, through a store window. In short, where forms can be surprised and made bodily and erotic again. This project is utopian. Yet the store did not pretend to be free of commercial exchange. On the contrary, again, cash register presided over the installation. Nor was it oblivious to death. In the midst of this festival of the living object, bride mannequin brooded like a ghostly Miss Havisham of the Lower East Side. Okay, on to the next set of contraries. Hard and soft. Oldenburg exhibited several of the store objects at the Green Gallery in September 1962. This presentation pulled them into the usual frame of the art exhibition, and the success of the show, financial as well as critical, did not sit well with him. The store is worn out, Goldenberg declared flatly in August 1963. And in search of a new consistency, he relocated to Los Angeles for over a year. The difference between the two cities struck him strongly. In New York and Brooklyn, one sees the degradation and terror of production, Goldenberg wrote, while in Los Angeles, one is aware only of the finished project. In this paradise of industrialism, he continued, the object and the home have taken command completely. This insight guided his primary project in LA, Bedroom Ensemble, first shown in New York in January 1964. And altogether, there are three versions. Although the store objects are as hard as plaster, many appear poopy, again, as if enlivened by direct involvement with bodily processes. In Bedroom Ensemble, on the contrary, an absolute rigidity pervades and the body is absented. Everything is subsumed by a design logic and the appeal of the commodity is suspended. Not public and subject matter like the street and the store, Bedroom Ensemble is also not private. Rather, it represented for Goldenberg a new topos of the impersonal home, where collective dreams are processed through commercial forms. Far from rechanneled, consumerist desire freezes here, and the metamorphic imagination let loose in the store is arrested. On the opposite walls of Bedroom Ensemble are versions of abstract paintings in black and white, horizontals and verticals on the left, four small rectangles on the right, in an art for informel style that has become rote ornament. This theme of decorative abstraction extends across the faux functional objects that make up the installation. It is there in the couch, the headboard, and the bed cushions, all upholstered in synthetic zebra. In a nice touch, Goldenberg throws a leopard coat over the zebra couch, as well as in the bedside and dressing tables, all painted in a dark design of turquoise and marine blues. The two lampshades complete this abstract decor with shapes that recall metamorphic rock. Again, metamorphosis is petrified. Decoration subsumes not only early modernist abstraction, the old opposition of geometric and biomorphic models offered by Alfred Barr, but also the latest pop style represented by the white fluffy rug on the floor and the black final objet on the couch. Everything in Bedroom Ensemble is governed by geometry, abstraction, rationality, Goldenberg remarked, with nothing real or human. Most blatant in this respect are the fake fur and vinyl, which detach Bedroom Ensemble from the hand of the artist, an effect furthered by the fabrication of the furniture by a carpenter on the basis of engineering diagrams. In this way, the set is taken completely out of the functional class with no use value whatsoever. It is also removed from us bodily. When it exhibited, it is chained off. Yet Bedroom Ensemble was distanced from the start, based as it was on a newspaper advertisement. That is, it arrived already mediated, a replication less of an actual bedroom than of an illustrated showroom. As with the studio and the store, in the store, these two spaces are collapsed. And when exhibited, the gallery absorbs both. This picture become installation exists somewhere between the actual thing and the representation of it. It is its own simulacrum. This is most evident in the foreshortening of the bed and the couch, an aspect of the ad made literal in the installation. Although Goldenberg called it a rehearsal of machine style, Bedroom Ensemble captures a new stage in capitalist society in which the dominant term is less exchange value than display value, in which product and ad, commodity and sign are structurally one. A simulacral contagion takes over the domestic scene, and it extends to the cultural domain that once resisted it the most, abstract painting. In a nasty turn, in the dialectic of modernist art, an all-over abstraction becomes the template for an all-over decor that spreads from surface to surface like a bacterial bloom. If not long before Bedroom Ensemble, abstract expressionism could claim to express a new man. Here there is no subject at all. Literally no one is at home. The very title suggests an arrangement without inhabitants. In this light, Bedroom Ensemble could serve as a dioramic display in a future museum of natural history. The aspirational American middle-class consumer circa 1963. After the eroticism of the store, then, the deathliness of the street returns in Bedroom Ensemble, but in a different guise, not the lumpen homelessness of the Bowery, but the affluent airlessness of Beverly Hills. In the same year that Warhol produced his caustic silkscreens of car crashes, race riots, and electric chairs under the rubric Death in America, Oldenburg offered his own distinctive version. All styles are on the side of death, he wrote of this piece. The bedroom as rational tomb, Pharaoh's or Plato's bedroom. This note, as cryptic as it is grim, implies minimally that the co-option of artists' lifestyle is deadly, with lifestyle here difficult to distinguish from death style. And maximally, that style as such, any stylization, is fatal. If mimetic excess in the store aimed to make hostile objects human, the same strategy in Bedroom Ensemble has the opposite effect. And whereas the store attempted to reconnect subject and object through an erotico-mystical attraction, Bedroom Ensemble submits both subject and object to the logic of the commodity sign. It is a reified world that resists any making over. It is as though Oldenburg designed the installation as a programmatic demonstration, either of the limits of his own transformative energies, or of the conditions that his metamorphic art was pledged against, or both at once. Ever the self-contrarian, Oldenburg pivoted again from the rigidity of Bedroom Ensemble to the pliability of his soft sculptures. Although he had shown a few fabric pieces stuffed with kapok at the Green Gallery in fall 1962, specifically Floorburger, Floor Coke, and Floor Cone, he took up this line in earnest now, aided by the synthetic materials used in Bedroom Ensemble. In direct opposition to that installation, though, the soft sculptures suggest that nothing is reified once and for all, which is also implied by his principle that only hard originals are taken as subjects for softening. Oldenburg first developed a piece in cardboard, then worked up a version in muslin, painted a thin white, which he called a ghost, and then produced the final sculpture. Although modern artists from Medardo Rosso to Piero Manzoni had experimented with softness, no one insisted on this quality quite like Oldenburg. Oldenburg imagined his softening as a death blow to the functionality of the object as well as to the classicism of sculpture. This example, Toilet, is a tribute to Duchamp that is also a travesty of his ready-made. First, the variability of the soft sculpture, its resistance to any one position, is an affront to an art traditionally dedicated to fixity. Second, the soft pieces trouble the usual verticality of the medium with the very force, gravity, that it has always worked to overcome. Uprightness is threatened with overturn and the implicit promise of transcendence with the explicit possibility of collapse. Yet Oldenburg did not regard the effects of gravity as anti-formal. In fact, he called gravity his favorite form creator. Nor did he oppose the formal to the formless, which would only keep that binary in place. Rather, with sly humor, he once again developed a subversive medium of indefinite form in which the formal appears as informal. Whereas the body disappeared in Bedroom Ensemble, it returns in the soft sculptures, which are governed by an indirect anthropomorphism. The body parallels are reinforced, Oldenburg wrote, by the use of flesh-like materials, vinyl, for example, and sculptural insides, hard like bone and soft like fat. Moreover, gravity acts on many of the soft pieces as it does on many of our bodies. They slouch and sag the way fleshy humans do. More generally, Oldenburg suggests an entropy. The object is reduced to nature, left a heap, that undermines the pumped up perfection, not only of the ideal sculptural figure, but also of the shiny new commodity. They too are deflated through softening. Okay, the final section, promiscuous form. In 1967, troubled by the Vietnam War, Oldenburg wrote a short text titled America, War and Sex, in which he casts his work in terms of the struggle between life and death drives. After the alternation between the street and the store, and between bedroom ensemble and the soft sculpture, his thought turned morbid again. This is announced perhaps again in jest, perhaps, but not really, by his ceramic jello death masks. He calls them life masks, but at the same time, as televised deaths, both in Southeast Asia jungles and in American streets, at the same time, he once more confronted the limits of his strategy of mimetic excess. I wrestle to turn terror into form. Recall the 1967 photo of Oldenburg in his studio with Freud a Vinket stenciled on the door. In Freud, joy, let alone life, hardly wins in the end. And at this moment, the skull tipped the balance in favor of death for Oldenburg. Although he treats it lightly here, this is a real fear, and he pushed back against it with his aesthetic of promiscuous form as best he could. I've argued that as Oldenburg explores such contraries as sex and death and hard and soft, he demonstrates that each term calls out for its other. This pertains to his view of subjectivity as well. I am a complex of opposites, a confused mingling, he wrote in 1959. One moment the death wish rules, the next the life wish. We can refer this resistance to dualism. To his biography, Oldenburg was raised in Christian Science, which rejects any dichotomy between spiritual life and the physical world. But that alone hardly explains his persistent drive to combine and to transform. For Oldenburg, the erotico-mystical attraction of subjects and objects pulls in both directions. I love this lady. And the sign is good too good to be true, but it's there. On the one hand, he insisted that objects live, that they not only think, but also obsess. Further, Oldenburg saw art as an essential way into this life of things. Art must be obsessive or it has no power, he wrote in a variant of the surrealist formula that beauty must be convulsive or not be. On the other hand, in a move equally fundamental to his work, Oldenburg also projected subjectivity into things. Early on, he noted his animistic empathy with objects. And over time, this projection became a habit of his work. I animate the inanimate and attribute human qualities to non-human creatures. In fact, Oldenburg performs the pathetic fallacy so flagrantly that we are made aware of how pervasive it is in our everyday lives. The subject of my expression, he remarked in 1963, is the forms that the living human being can take in all its parts, mental and physical. At the same time, Oldenburg insisted that this anthropomorphism is applied not sentimentally, but factually and playfully. And usually it is a matter of form first. Most of my pieces are body images, Oldenburg remarked. I didn't set out to upset sculptural values. I simply set out to project myself into form. Certainly, along with metamorphosis by substitution of materials or qualities like vinyl for flesh or soft for hard, this projection is a prime device of his relentless transformation of motifs, which he calls promiscuous form. In drawings as well as in sculptures, Oldenburg wrote, the doubling, the symmetry, refers to the human body, with parallels drawn between the objects represented and the parts of the body, ears, eyes, nostrils, limbs, breasts, testicles, etc. The analogies are often comic. The giant tube of toothpaste is self-portrait as an odalisque, and sometimes cruel. Oldenburg described his softened airflow engine as a 1935 Chrysler flayed, as in an anatomical chart. It is not easy to see the human so contorted into the artificial and vice versa. At the same time, his promiscuous formalism is a corrosive riposte to the persistent call in fascisms, past and present, to reforge the body metallically and phallically. This project to overcome divisions, to connect objects and subjects, is most pronounced in the store. These are rips out of reality, perceptions like snapshots, embodiments of glances, Oldenburg said, of his fabricated products. And he intended these eye clusters as a formal model for a kind of visual experience typical of urban life, which involves, again, fragmentation, simultaneousness, superimposition. Paradoxically, this mimesis of vision works to de-differentiate things as much as to distinguish them. Consider Ice Cream Cone and Heel, which was originally subtitled Fragment of Two Signs Confused. It is difficult to make out what is what here. Here, seeing is not really in the surface of clarifying. Rather, even as each eye cluster is ripped from its urban setting, it is regrounded in the body of the viewer who snatches it with his or her glance. In another loaded phrase that captures this corporeal involvement, Oldenburg described his store objects as birth flesh fragments, torn from the continuity of matter. The subject-object connection is brutally direct. An objective expressionism that Oldenburg once acknowledged borders on object pornography. Consider in this light two girls' dresses, which evokes a sighting in a store window. Like a double victory of Samothrace, the dresses are weirdly animated, as if by the mobility of the viewer as passerby. Imagine Abby Warburg on Orchard Street. Against a blue backdrop, the dresses are painted white and pink, as though they are literally fleshed out, or again, as though they partake of our own bodily presence. In short, as embodiments of glances, such sculptures appear both ripped out visually and incorporated physically. It is as if our looking becomes part of the objects, or conversely, as if in looking, we tear them away and take them in at the same time. This cross-incorporation is an emphatic way to connect objects and subjects. It is also a way to play with gender. Oldenburg invites a cross-dressing of spectatorship, whereby male viewers can try on female tights and female viewers male shirts. Moreover, as his language suggests, his treatment damages the object even as it animates it. Often the two actions converge in Oldenburg, as in My Other Artists. The original inspiration of the store, he once remarked, was a butcher shop. In fact, he projected every exhibition as a place where the parts of the body are displayed. As Oldenburg acknowledges, there is violence in this tearing away and taking in, and it stems from his understanding of vision as a process of breaking up and layering over. They are shown as fragments of the field of seeing, Oldenburg wrote of his store objects. Yet paradoxically, he finds an integration precisely in this disruption, for a unity of fragments is what one sees. At the outset of this talk, I claim that his project to undo oppositions is psychoanalytical in nature. Already with the street, Oldenburg played with the moniker Dr. Klaus Oldenburg, Doctor of Psychoanalytical Nature Study. Clearly, he was sympathetic to the liberatory thought of contemporary Freudian Marxists such as Herbert Marcuse. To liberate is my desire is another Oldenburg motto. In Eros and Civilization of 1955, Marcuse insisted that regression assumes a progressive function, and that the forbidden images and impulses of childhood begin to tell the truth that reason denies. Both are propositions that Oldenburg affirmed fully. We also know that during summer 1961, while at work on the store, he read another key text of Freudo-Marxism, Life Against Death, The Psychoanalytical Meaning of History, 1959, by Norman O. Brown. Much in this extraordinary book resonates with Oldenburg. Above all, the radical claim that psychoanalysis aims to tap the energies of both life and death in order to abolish every dualism and to allow human culture to be reconnected with the human body. For Brown, art was a crucial ally in this struggle for the abolition of repression. Artists are the spokesman for what is repressed in the present, he averred. And since our repressed desires are the desires we had unrepressed in childhood, they must follow Freud into the closest anatomy of infantile sexuality. Brown thus conceived art as an anamnesis of the sources of pleasure denied by the reality principle of capitalist society. And he insisted that one path to this recovery through regression was to become one with the objects in the world. A project of incorporation that foregrounds the primitive oral phase above all. This is the position that Oldenburg took up in the store. What does psychoanalytical nature study have to do with promiscuous form? What I rejoice in, Oldenburg wrote already in summer 1960, is the discovery of consistencies and similarities, unities, correspondences. Things look like other things, he insisted, or rather they can be made to appear so. That is, they can be forced into similarity in a way that compels a simultaneous recognition of dissimilarity, such that the objects in question are rendered familiar and strange at once. This comic likeness, unlikeness, is crucial to his promiscuous formalism. His positive barbarism is his way to begin again, to produce a new world of refreshed signs. I am Robinson Crusoe, he wrote in Provincetown. Two pieces float up to me, asking to be joined. Early on, Oldenburg set a range of possibilities for promiscuous form, from identity through resemblance to affinity, and countless examples along follow the spectrum of likeness and unlikeness. They appear throughout his work, which are produced often through extreme acts of softening, of absurd or absurd jumps in scale, or both. The ultimate version of forced identity is his persistent use of equals, the equal sign. Frequently in drawings and notes, he insists on formulas such as pizza equals toilet equals plug equals iron equals switch. Such equations, which are really transformations, explain his attraction to components such as light switches and electrical plugs. However, his main equalizer is the ray gun. Again, it is the phallic copula that connects all things. This magical connector can comprehend classical sculpture, great cities, even entire continents. He once said, Africa is the largest ray gun. And its slogan, Annihilate, Illuminate, suggests how. A 1965 watercolor with this title shows a ray gun shooting equals in primary colors. The fundamental material of art, Oldenburg tells us, is jaculation. Here the ray gun turns an ice cream cone into a mouse, then transforms the mouse into a mountain, then turns another ray gun into a female leg, and so on. In all instances, the equals sign continues beyond the page, as if into the world at large. In a ray gun ejaculation, which again is both destructive and creative, unlikeness is annihilated and likeness illuminated. This annihilation illumination is his vital troping of the creative destruction associated with capitalist transformation, or at least of the reductive abstraction at the heart of capitalist exchange. Oldenburg identified first with his transformative ray gun, and then with his other great equalizer, Mickey Mouse, whom he dubbed Mickey Morphic, as well as the sport of forms. Consider in this regard symbolic self-portrait with equals, which shows his head topped with an ice bag for a beret and surrounded by key works diagrammed as in an engineering drawing. Note the repetition of equals in the drawing. The other signs for addition, subtraction, and multiplication and division appear too, as well as the emphasis on the switch and the plug as prime transformers in his art. The objects are shown in the order in which they are made, Oldenburg tells us. Reading from left to right, from the Good Humor Bar of 1963 through the Geometric Mouse of 1969, they circulate about the artist's head like the representation of unconsciousness in the comics. Along with this identification of switch plug Mickey, his association of transformation with an unconscious mediated by mass culture is telling, but it seems to come at a physical cost. Drops of blood dot his forehead, eye, nostril, and tongue. This face is divided in half vertically, Oldenburg continues allegorically. One side shows the kindly aspect of the artist, the other his brutal one. I alternated between the image of a magician and that of a clown. Mickey assumes these two guises as well. Think of the Sorcerer's Apprentice in Fantasia. And apparently, like Mickey, Oldenburg feels as much victim as master of his fate. I began these Mellon lectures with Mickey Mouse, and here at the end, he returns. At first, Oldenburg saw in Mickey what Walter Benjamin wanted to see, a sport of forms. In the early Disney films, Benjamin wrote, a car is no heavier than a straw hat, and the fruit on the tree becomes round as quickly as a hot air balloon. In his own work, Oldenburg cranks this metamorphosis up. The car equals the hat. The fruit is a balloon. Everything and everyone is potentially Mickey Morphic. Crucially for Benjamin, Mickey teaches us how to survive a civilization turned barbaric through these adaptations and transformations. Here it is different from Oldenburg, or at least it is by the late 1960s when his thought takes a dark turn and promiscuous form gives way to a Mickey unconscious whose associations are mechanical, a system of iconography indeed. As Mickey becomes a fixed logo in the Disney Corporation, Walt died in 1966, so he becomes Geometric Mouse in the Oldenburg nature study. The sport of forms turns into a cenotaphic museum. Mickey no longer resists the dark side. He becomes its mascot. This is an abrupt way to suggest that the historical conditions that prompted positive barbarism had changed, that brutal aesthetics was no match for the society of spectacle. So joy does not win here. I'd hope to conclude on a high note with Oldenburg, or at least on a light one, given that he is one of the great comic artists ever, but he's also a realist. His art, his time, our time, does not allow for a redemptive last word. Thanks for listening, and thanks for hanging in there over the talks.
This has been a National Gallery of Art production.